Hello, listeners. This podcast is hosted by International Idea. In the next minutes, we will help you make sense of what's happening today in democracy worldwide.
Hello, I'm Billy Phillips, and I'm the Communications Officer for International Idea in the Asia and the Pacific region. I'm joined on the sidelines of ANU's APSA conference by Professor Lisa Hill of the University of Adelaide, and we're here to talk about lowering the voting age in Australia. Should we bring it down to as young as 16 or 17? Professor Hill, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you. What can you tell us about this idea? Is it a new idea? Is it gaining traction?
It's being debated currently in a lot of settings around the world. There's over 100 members of the US Congress, for example, that support it. Lots of other settings, they have already lowered it, and it hasn't been seen to have any adverse effects. And it's gaining ground here, and there was this bill debated in 2018 in the federal parliament, which the Greens and the ALP supported and the Liberals opposed, and it nearly would have got up, except they couldn't agree on whether it should be compulsory or not. The Greens and the ALP couldn't agree on whether it should be compulsory or not. But we'd have it now if they could have agreed on that, if the Greens had conceded that it should be compulsory. Yeah.
Right, so what do proponents of lowering the voting age say? Is this demand coming from younger people primarily, or is it coming from across the age brackets in the community?
A vast majority of adults do not want young people to have a vote, 16 and 17 year olds to have the vote. It's young people that want it. And so there isn't a lot of community support for it, but there's a lot of advocacy from the peak organisations for 16 to 17 year olds, and young people themselves are pushing hard for it. So, and the thing is, it may be that the public don't think it's a good idea, but it is feasible. It's politically feasible now that we have a Labor government, assuming the Greens would concede on the compulsory component.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in terms of people that are against the idea of lowering the age to vote, you mentioned that it's, you know, the wide majority of the community, particularly older people. Do those concerns, I guess, stem from ideas about the maturity of younger people or people in their late teens?
Yeah, people don't. They think that young people don't have the moral maturity to vote, that they don't have the political competence to vote. They worry that they'll make decisions, bad decisions, against their own interests, like lowering bedtime and having no internet controls and lowering the age of consent and getting rid of compulsory schooling. And then they also worry that the bad decisions of the young will be visited on everybody else. But according to the Condorcet theorem, which you may not be familiar with as a voting studies person, the more people you bring into an electorate, the better its decisions are, assuming that there's a 50 plus 1% at least chance that those new enfranchisees will make good decisions. Now, when you look at all the testing on children and experiments with 16 to 17 year olds on their competence to vote, their ability to cast a congruent vote, that is a vote that accords with their own preferences. Not everyone can cast a congruent vote. They say, oh, I like this, and then they vote for the party that doesn't like that. Young people can cast a congruent vote. At the age of 16 and 17, they have the moral maturity to make sensible, rational decisions, thinking about conflicts of interest, thinking about the interests of others, being fair, understanding distributive justice. They can do it all. There are two kinds of cognition, hot and cold cognition. And on the hot cognition, when you're with your friends and when you're in a situation of heightened emotionality, the decisions aren't that great. But this is a cold cognition situation, like it's like a test. And they're just as good at doing that as everybody else. So their decisions won't be bad ones. The only thing that they're a little bit deficient on is political knowledge. But what happens in this system is, because it's compulsory, when people know they have to vote, they start picking up knowledge. That's why Australians are more knowledgeable than people in lots of other settings, because they know they have to vote. So they're actually more politically sophisticated, and that will happen to the young as well. Plus, unlike my generation, young kids now have civics classes, so they can be taught how to do it. They're already in that setting where they can learn how to do it. So it doesn't concern me. Some of these reasons don't concern me.
Mm. So taking our listeners back to 2018 when there was a proposed bill,
yeah.
Talk us through what was in that proposal. What age were people suggesting that we would be allowed to then enrol, and what other kind of frameworks were proposed to be put in place to support that?
It was just to lower the enrolment age to 14 and then to lower the voting age to 16 to 17. And it was felt that it was introduced by the Greens, Jordan Steele Johns, and he thought it would be good for intergenerational justice, which I agree. He thought.
What does that mean, intergenerational justice?
Well, it's where one generation, the older generation, politically they do a lot of short-termism, and where they lack generativity. So they make short-term decisions without thinking of the long-term consequences, which politicians do because it's a three-year election cycle. And also they don't do what they should do, which is generativity, which is this attitude that of providing for future generations and thinking of yourself in species terms, as, you know, rather than in generational terms. Politics doesn't work like that. People just think in their own terms of their own self-interest and in terms of their own generation. So older generations have been legislating against the interests of young people for decades. And so they've destroyed the planet that they don't have to live in. They've made sure, they've enriched themselves at the expense of young people. Now there's a lot of wealth transfer between the young to the older generations. Meanwhile, the youth electorate's shrinking anyway due to slowing birth rates, but the youth generation, youth electorate's shrinking also because youth are demobilising. So the Greens thought, well, this might remobilise young people, which it would. So I think they had very good reasons, and the ALP was on board. Look, it may or may not have gotten through because the Morrison government, as I said, opposed it, but it had a chance. And the ALP still supports the idea. So
you mentioned concerns about the environment. Younger people these days, I think, are widely considered to be more politically engaged than perhaps they ever have been. We see younger people leading climate change protests, even issues around immigration, refugees, war. We see young people really activated in those spaces. Would it be fair to say that giving them the option to vote would be a good, you know, pressure release or a valve for that engagement for them?
First of all, I'm not sure that young people are more politically engaged. They're certainly less electorally engaged. They're certainly less engaged in arena politics, like mainstream, joining parties, being involved in elections. But they're more involved in other ways, non-arena ways. That's true. Yes, I think it would be a really, really important valve because there's been a lot of studies done about the anxieties of the young. They're super anxious about their financial futures and for good reason. They're the ones, for a start, younger people are more likely to be unemployed, twice as likely to be homeless and all things like that. They're less likely to be able to own a home and to have secure employment, to have good super and to have a nice old age. So this is causing a lot of anxiety when you do psychological studies. Young people are very anxious about their future, their financial future, and also you've probably heard of climate anxiety. It's a particular kind of anxiety. Young people are more pessimistic than any generation before. They're not happy and they're not looking forward to the future. And often they, along with that anxiety, is feelings of loss of control or lack of control, powerlessness, feelings of betrayal by older generations, but also notably feelings of guilt, that they are standing by doing nothing. Now they're doing what they can, but they can't get right into the heart of power and decision making. That would open a door, because then you could have people, young people standing for Parliament earlier, but you'd have them with some electoral power, and it would alleviate some of that anxiety. Anxiety is often due to powerlessness, of being out of control of a situation, with people making bad decisions in your name, and I think this would address that problem.
In terms of young people's responsibilities and what they look like in Australia at, say, 16 or 17, broadly speaking, and it does differ a little bit from state to territory, they can enter the military, they can consent to medical treatment, they can hold a job and crucially pay taxes, they can get married as young as 16 with parental consent. But what does it mean when we'll trust a young person to pay taxes and hold a gun, but we don't trust them to vote?
Well, it's an injustice, isn't it? And this is the same reason why the voting age was lowered in the 70s, because the idea was all these people had gone off to fight the Vietnam War and they couldn't vote. So Whitlam lowered the voting age. So, yeah, it's an injustice. No taxation without representation. It's a very, very old principle. Goes back to antiquity. You can find it in classical writings, which I have found. I've actually found women saying the same thing in 300 before Common Era, a woman called Hortensia. So it's an injustice to exclude young people. I mean, when I look at all the reasons that are given for why young people shouldn't be voting, none of them seem to have any standing to me. And all the reasons for allowing them to vote seem reasonable. Equality, equity, they meet all the obligations, they contribute. Why shouldn't they be able to vote and protect their own interests? The all-affected interest principle, which is that if you're affected by an electoral decision, you should be maybe able to participate in them. Same as you know, permanent residence, as you mentioned before. So I just can't think of a single reason that has any standing, except this one, which at first when I read it, I thought it's sentimental and silly. And it's this interest children have in play that we have. We shouldn't be asking 16 to 17 year olds to bear the burdens of adulthood when you're supposed to be in this period of play when you're just relaxing and enjoying yourself. But then I thought, well, let's face it, how much fun are young people really having? You know, not much. And, you know, I've seen it said, look, this will only increase our anxiety by letting them vote, taking on this responsibility for the outcome. There's no evidence that it increases anxiety, and I'm pretty sure it will reduce the anxiety. So, you know, the United Nations instruments on how the rights of the child ask us to leave children in peace to play, that we shouldn't do anything that interferes with their development, which some might argue asking them to vote would. But it also asks us to hear their voices, to let them to speak when people are making decisions on their behalf. And when I was writing this paper, I spoke to a friend of mine, Dr. Fran Gale, who's a lecturer in social work at University of Western Sydney, and she said to me, if we had listened to children all this time we've been human beings, listened about their lives, think of all the abuse and neglect and misery we could have prevented. We like to think that children, the representations of children aren't always very accurate, and they aren't always. Sometimes there's a fantasy in there, sometimes there's a misrepresentation that, oh no, I didn't do it. But a lot of the time they can be, there's no one better place than they themselves to tell us, what is it like being you? That's the whole idea behind One Vote, One Value. Every person knows best their own interests. So now a 9-year-old might not, but still we would listen. We still should listen to a 9-year-old more, but a 16 or 17-year-old does know.
And so which countries have lowered the voting age, and have we been able to draw out any conclusions about enfranchising younger people at the vote?
Well, I've got a list here, so forgive me if I refer to it. Austria, and sometimes it's not in all elections, but Austria, okay. Argentina, Brazil, Guernsey, Jersey, Isle of Man, Malta, Scotland, might have already mentioned Scotland, Belgium, in EU elections only, Nicaragua. What we've learned there is that it does increase turnout, so people will tell you it doesn't increase turnout. So there's studies even here that say it wouldn't have increased turnout. That's only when you calculate it on register on the basis of RV, registered voters, but if you calculate it on proportion of the voting age population, voting eligible population, does increase it. In some places, like in Scotland, these younger voters turned out in higher numbers than people over 18. So it does raise turnout, even when it's voluntary. The other lesson we get from this is there was no harm. Mm. No harm was caused. I can't think of a single case where enlarging the franchise had a bad effect. It always has a good effect. And a lot of people don't realise this, but one of the reasons that Australia is such an easy place to live and such a prosperous, stable place to live is due to compulsory voting, because everybody votes. It's much harder to have extremism here, political extremism, because of compulsory voting. Corruption levels are lower. Wealth distribution is better. There's less social disadvantage. You know, we have all these problems, but they're not to the same degrees in other places. We have a kind of a more law-abiding or pro-social population, actually.
And you put that down to compulsory voting.
I do. You know, you saw that with through COVID. And the government says, oh, I'd like you all to stay at home or not stay at home. Some complained, but most Australians thought those complainers marching in the streets were silly. Most people did do as they were asked. In other places, they did not comply. And I think this is because Australians feel that they've signed the social contract. Mm. And because our elections are so well run, so high levels of integrity, so we all voted and the process was legitimate. No one ever says after an Australian election that wasn't the actual winner. Occasionally there's miscounting, occasionally there's a problem, but no one ever says that's not who won. People trust the electoral authorities because they're trustworthy. And then they abide by the umpire's decision. All right, I didn't vote for this government, but they won fair and square. They're the umpire. If they've asked me to stay home during COVID, I will. And I'll wear a mask if I'm asked.
So any data to suggest from the countries that have a lower voting age that 16, 17-year-olds simply vote the way their parents do, and so it wouldn't affect the overall result?
There's no data for that, and you wouldn't want to look for it, because over 18-year-olds do that too. Mm-hmm. Everybody does that, because one of the strongest indicators of how you vote is how your parents vote, because class is inherited. So it's rational to vote how your parents vote. But there's no data either way. And it's not a problem. It's not a problem if you vote how your parents voted, but there's no evidence that young people are vote in a sillier way or less congruent way with their own interests than anyone else. So I don't see that as being a problem. And of course, because we've got the secret ballot here, young people can do what they like.
Right. So would you propose then, in an ideal world, that voting would be lowered to, say, 15, 16, 17, but that it would be compulsory at that younger age, or should it be voluntary until you reach 18?
Well, I'd say go down to 16. Okay. 16, 17-year-olds. And definitely compulsory.
Compulsory?
Definitely. Now, everyone, just about everybody says, oh, no, make it voluntary, let them try it out and get familiar with the system. Well, in what way would people get familiar with the system? Some would vote, so they'd get familiar. The ones that didn't vote wouldn't be familiar. So how's anyone familiarising themselves? Mm-hmm. Better to make everyone familiar at the same time. But the main problem with this argument is the only 16 to 17-year-olds that would vote advantage kids with a lot of social capital. The disadvantaged, called kids, kids living on the street, the very people, unemployed kids, the very people that need the protection that voting actually does give you, wouldn't be voting. So it would actually entrench inequality even further. Mm-hmm. One of the things about compulsory voting is it raises turnout in a socially even way. Where you have a voluntary system, you usually just get the well-off, white, home-owning, not new immigrants, you know, long-standing citizens, people with first language speakers. They're the ones voting, and the disadvantaged don't vote. But here, everyone votes. Mm-hmm. And so we don't want to set a precedent with this sort of two classes of voters. It would just entrench inequality further. And it would defeat the whole purpose of introducing this mechanism, which is to raise turnout, because it would only raise turnout in a socially uneven way, and it would defeat the whole purpose of compulsory voting in the first place, which is to smooth out social inequality and to get socially even turnout across classes. Now you would create a super class of inequality, of people that may never get into the habit of voting. So I'm really against it.
Why does it seem like lawmakers, policymakers, authority figures more broadly are opposed to enfranchising more people. So you mentioned homeowners. There was a time when you could only vote if you owned a home. There was a time not so long ago when you could only vote if you were a man, if you were white, etc., etc. So why does it seem like power holders generally are constantly opposed to expanding the vote and enfranchising more people?
Well, there's a saying. It was coined by Walter Dean Burnham, a very famous political scientist. If you don't vote, you don't count. The less, and also politicians know who their customers are.
And who are their customers?
Well, they like their customers just to be a certain type that they can serve. We've got more and diverse customers, your job gets tougher. Now, a lot of the time, parties don't want certain people to be enfranchised because they won't vote for them. Now, we suspect that the Young and Greens, so this also suggests that they're not just following their parents, were more likely to vote for Labor or for the Labor or the Greens, and they won't vote for the Liberal Party, but I don't know what they'll do. And that can change. And so people often say that's why Labor and the Greens wanted to enfranchise the Young and why the Liberal Party opposed it. But look, Conservative governments always try and keep out people that won't vote for them, and more Liberal parties always want to, or Liberal in the smaller sense, always want to enfranchise those people. But honestly, looking at it from an impartial point of view, if you are a Democrat, it's not defensible to exclude anyone that's capable of voting and that has a stake and is a stake in what happens and has interests and is affected by what happens. So people like holding on to power. It's that simple. And whenever you see someone opposing the franchise, you can bet your bottom dollar they're usually up to something. They're trying to exclude somebody, okay? Because no harm ever came from a more diverse, more inclusive polity. The only harm that happens is to parties that don't get elected, and who cares if some parties don't get elected and others do. The most important thing is that everyone has their say. We have political equality and we have inclusiveness, because we know, and this goes right back to Aristotle, who was the first procedural democrat, the reason that you give everyone a stake in the decisions is so you'll have social stability and happiness, and that's what we want, really, a happy, stable, flourishing polity. And you do get that when you have more inclusive demos.
Do you think young people in Australia are generally perceived to be by power holders, generally perceived to be immature, generally perceived to not be able to speak for themselves?
Well, I mean, older generations always think that.
I mean, our MP for youth, our Minister for Youth, I'm sorry, who is a very accomplished woman, she's 55 years old. And not to say that older people don't have perspective and long-term wisdom, etc., etc., but the Minister for Youth is not a youth.
Correct. And this is terrible. Just don't forget that we've had a Minister for Women's Affairs. It was a man that didn't seem particularly interested in what women wanted.
We've had ministers
for Indigenous Affairs that were not Indigenous routinely. And as you say, this is outrageous. And you're quite right. We need a young person to understand a young person's perspective, because an older person can't necessarily understand that.
Do you think younger people were sufficiently heard in the 2018 inquiry to the proposed bill to lower the vote?
No, I don't think they were. When I look, I read every single submission, and I read all the witness reports as well, and everyone wanted it. But in the end, look, the Labor members on the J-Scam knocked it back because it wasn't going to be compulsory. But I didn't feel like there was hardly any. There are only a few submissions that didn't want the voting age to be lowered. But of course there's the other factor that the Australian public doesn't want the voting age to be lowered. But that's not always the only consideration when you're making a legislative change. The public probably weren't very happy about it being lowered to 18 when it was, and they probably weren't very happy at the time when women were enfranchised. And sometimes it's really a case of too bad, this is the right thing to do. Usually we try and do what the people want, but not every time. Sometimes leaders have to lead us in a positive direction.
Yeah.
And this might be that positive direction.
So in a submission to that inquiry, a student representative claimed that young people have lost trust in institutions and politics broadly. Why do you think that might be, that they've lost trust or lost faith in these institutions to serve them and protect their own interests?
Because these institutions haven't served them and protected their interests. That's exactly why. All the policies are geared towards older generations and the preservation of their wealth, their superannuation, their nest egg, their secure jobs, their homes, and has not thought about, perhaps we shouldn't enact policies that destroy the planet and send it, because the idea is it's short-termism. I won't be here to have to worry about it anyway. So their interests haven't been served. Young people's welfare, in objective terms, has declined. They're more likely to be homeless, unemployed, poor, marginalised in every different way that you can be. And so their interests haven't been served. So, of course, they've lost trust. I mean, everybody's lost trust in the institutions, it's true, but young people more so.
So you mentioned sometimes leaders just have to lead and take decisions that may not be popular within the context of the Australian public not really favouring lowering the vote. But would that be democratic for leaders to make the decision almost unilaterally against what the majority of the electorate really wants?
Well, it depends what you mean by democratic. Is it doing what the people want all the time? Not necessarily. Sometimes the people can be wrong. Now, if you're doing something that honours a democratic value, such as political equality and inclusion, then it's not undemocratic. And then what the public wants is an undemocratic thing. So, look, I've got to tell you, there's no rule book on democracy. I'm just spitballing like everyone else here on what should be done. But a good example might be the seatbelt rule. Now, you're young and won't remember this, but I remember when the seatbelt rule was brought in. And everyone's like, oh, I'm not wearing a seatbelt, stupid seatbelts, and what a waste of time, and you can't force me. And everyone just started to think, oh, this is quite good. You know, I had an accident and I survived it, and there's so-and-so had an accident, he wasn't wearing his seatbelt. And pretty soon, people start to do self-paternalism. They retrospectively approve a decision that was made on their behalf. So the state was paternalistic in that sense, saying, look, this is in your own good. I know you don't want to do it, but it's for your own good, and the state was right. Now, paternalism is very dangerous, and I don't recommend that the state always be paternalistic, but sometimes the state has more insight. The state thinks, well, everyone has to pay for all these medical costs that people think of the lives we can save and the money we could save and the future pensions we could save for people with disabilities if everyone just put their seatbelt on. They had a better knowledge of the consequences of not wearing your seatbelt and the effect it would have on everybody else. And then, you know, what happens in democracy? Sometimes you do something unpopular, then people get used to this idea. And then, but if people don't like an idea, that's the beauty of democracy, especially when it's as responsive as ours, where everyone votes regularly, you know, every 3 years. If nothing, if something's not working, we can rescind it. So there's a place for, so it's not set in stone. We try something. We trust in our government to maybe be in the right, but if they're in the wrong, we can rescind it. So, there is a role for governments to lead, but there's hardly any literature or thought goes into the role of leading, sometimes against the will of the public. It's a very under-theorised area in democratic thought and practice.
Is it likely that that's what's happened when the vote has been expanded to include women or racial minorities, people who don't own homes, that maybe at the time there was a lot of backlash towards it, but 10, 20... 30 years down the road, we look back on it and go, oh yeah, I always supported women voting.
Yeah, of course, didn't they always? Yeah. Exactly. People get used to it, and retrospectively, they do self-paternalism. They go, yes, well, thank you, that was a good idea. A lot of women opposed being enfranchised. And now I think you have a lot of trouble finding a woman that doesn't think it's a good idea for her to vote. And a lot of people didn't think Indigenous people should be voting, but they were wrong. But luckily in Australia, most people thought Indigenous people should be voting and everything else. But yeah, we get used to things after a while, and it's in a healthy democracy, you can just change it. And we actually are quite an agile, responsive democracy. So there's never anything to be really feared from making a change. It can be changed again.
Do you think that's a misunderstanding about what democracy really is? You mentioned that, you know, making a decision in pursuit of a democratic value is more democratic than not making a decision that is the right call just because a majority of the population opposed it at one point in time. Do you think that your average voter really understands that distinction?
No. No, but what they do understand is if something's working, they'll accept it. If it's not affecting them adversely, they'll accept it. They'll give something a chance. So, no, I don't think people do understand that. And they're busy working and getting on with their lives. But I think all of us do accept that we can be wrong about something until we're proved otherwise, or until we're proved otherwise. So everyone can understand, oh, I got that wrong. So I don't see this as a problem. Governments all the time do things that the public do not like.
Yeah.
A lot of the public do not like governments being nice to disadvantaged people, but governments do it anyway. They can't understand often the policies that governments enact in the name of equity.
Yeah.
And they don't agree with it. But governments do it anyway. And we muddle along and it's okay. People see that, oh, look, I can live with this decision.
Do you think it's going to really take people who are older than, you know, 18 to 25, people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, coming out to bat for the concept of lowering the vote for the rest of the population to get on board? I wonder if younger people are not best positioned to convince older people why they should be able to vote. But I wonder if it's older people who would be better positioned to convince other older people we should expand the vote.
It's probably going to take older people because there's this thing called adultism where adults think they know best. And, you know, I don't know if you have children. When you have children, sometimes the things they want to do are not a great idea. I agree with you. I think if we have more adults, and the older the better, pushing this idea, we get better traction on it.
Yeah. I just wonder if you couldn't kind of retrofit this argument against people who don't believe in expanding the vote to younger people. So saying, okay, you don't want a 17-year-old to vote because you don't believe they're mature enough. That's fine. But then we won't take their taxes and we won't let them go to war. I think you might then have them go, oh, well, actually, maybe we should think about it some more.
Yeah, it would be good if we could do that experiment, wouldn't it? Another thought experiment would be this. One of the arguments against lowering the voting age is often made that, well, it's not really an injustice because we all suffer it and it's only temporary.
Mm.
So we're all kept out of the process. And then if you say to people, well, think about this, I'm going to raise the voting age to 40. So just be patient and watch all the decisions being made. Please be patient.
Mm-hmm.
Please keep paying your taxes, obviously, and obeying the laws and going to jail when I tell you you have to, but you can't vote. Then everyone can suddenly see, look, I don't want to be locked out of that. I don't want to have decisions made on my behalf, and I don't want to keep contributing and meeting my obligations as a citizen without having some say. So if we could just expose people to some of these thought experiments, maybe.
Yeah.
I just don't think people think about it very much. I keep reading, currently Australia is debating, and some. I don't really hear about the debate until someone, you know, conversation contacts me and say, could you comment on this? You know what I mean? I don't really hear people debating it, but I wish they would.
Yeah.
I wish they would.
Do you think voters or, you know, populations of countries like Australia think that democracy is kind of just a settled thing? We have it, we perfected it, there's no need to make any tweaks. I mean, of course, there's also discussions around voice to parliament.
Mm.
It's a separate issue, but I think, you know, there are comparisons that could be drawn there where you have people that are conservative in that small sense where they're like, we've got it sorted, let's not make any changes. Democracy is a real static thing.
You can always improve. And even in a democracy as good as ours, and you know, there are problems with it, you can still always make improvements. And the thing about our democracy, it's always trying really hard. Like, electoral commissions work really hard at inclusion and at integrity and things like that. You can always make improvements, and I don't think anyone thinks that you can't make more improvements or change and make it better. What I doubt, though, is that people are still committed to the actual idea of democracy, because especially among young people, at some points when they've surveyed young people, almost half of them say that they think there could be better systems than a democracy. But I'm not quite sure what they mean by that, but it sort of terrifies me a little bit.
Yeah.
Because do they mean... Sometimes they think it's an autocracy, like a benign dictator or something like that would be better. Well, of course, we all think that. But there's no such thing as a benign dictator. So that means autocracy.
Yeah.
And dictatorship. And so if young people really understood what that was like, they might not think it. But I think young people are actually losing faith in the very idea of democracy itself.
That could be because they're not able to participate in democracy.
Exactly. So let's give them a stake. The best way to get people invested in something is to give them a stake in it.
Yeah.
And to let them participate and let them treat them as mature self-governors that can make sensible decisions. And I think the best way to do that is to get them voting. So, you know, I'd really welcome it if it was lowered.
Lisa Hill, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Democracy Ideas podcast. Keep following International Idea on social media. We need all of you to participate in constructing better societies. Goodbye.